Berthe, thank you very much for having me over today in your office. Thanks for the invitation. Very happy to have a discussion with you about the current state of Bondora. To start off, I want to ask you what, I'm going to ask every platform on my stay. What is your current perception of Bondora, of the platform? From the inside perspective, where do you see the platform right now?
First, thank you for, being here again. It's great to have you and have you visit us and meet the team and meet offices. But in terms of Bondora, we feel stronger than ever before. We've been now operating already since 2008, right? So we've been on the market for a long time, I think longer than any other similar platform. We've gone through a big transformation. When I look back from where we started out as a pure peer-to-peer lending marketplace with no, risk management or process. So it was just matching to sort of, investors.
Open market.
Open market. To now where we're, looking to transform Bondora into a pan-European bank over the next 5 years. So there's been a pretty big step forward. We're now close to 200 people, a lot of them in Estonia, but a third or 40%, in different countries in Europe. So we're growing well. We've been, making quite interesting investments over the past year. First into new markets, a lot into technology and revamping our technology and the data stack. We're spending quite a lot of time and energy also on utilizing AI on day-to-day level. And obviously now the sort of, bank license transformation or the bank transformation that we've started to undertake, which is a long, journey, is something of that makes Bondora like extremely interesting and strong for the future.
Interesting, the aspect of the banking license is something I would like to address towards the later stages of the interview, but we definitely come back to this. When we talk about the perception of Bondora, one thing I'm curious about, do you perceive Bondora still as a peer-to-peer platform?
Not really, no. As such, I think, as said, we have transformed from that stage. In essence, today we actually have, within the Bondora Group, we have two separate businesses, essentially. So we have a regulated consumer lender that originates loans, based on the same criteria and regulations that are applied to banks for consumer lending, with all the necessary, risk management processes, etc. And then, we have the marketplace, basically that sells some of those claims to the general public. I think peer-to-peer lending as a concept now is where our roots are and where kind of like our, let's say, technical core is. But when we look at, I think the culture, and the people today at Bondora, then we've, especially as part of the transformation of becoming a bank, then we have, built up a very strong team with prior experience in banking as well as non-bank lending. And that is something that, like I said, Bondora is transforming into a bank. And I think that is the mindset that comes first, and then the license and the processes come later, in that sense that you, in order to become a bank, you need to kind of like start operating and acting and running the business, like a bank, earlier in order to actually be able to get the necessary licenses.
The question obviously derives from, a certain level of, let's say, confusion on my end, because I was often wondering in times of, let's say, last year, high inflation, increasing interest rates, you were often denying to, let's say, adjust the product of Go & Grow, let's say, the interest rate, because you often said we don't see ourselves in direct competition with other platforms. But obviously from my side, despite your explanation, you wouldn't you agree that your core is still the lending business? As you said, like, it's the backbone of the platform, and the way you facilitate them also through retail investors, how does it differ from, you know, the platforms that you distinguish? And then also as a consequence, who do you consider being your direct competitors in the market?
Okay. It's a good question. So, you know, I said maybe the answer to that question would have been considerably different 7 years ago than it is today. So first of all, Go and Grow as a product is very unique, right? So, you know, it's built on a number of layers that I don't think anyone on the market actually is able to compete with in that category where we are, right? So first of all, as an investor, you invest in a pool of loan fractions from across Europe. And what that does, it provides, you know, diversification and sustainable returns, right? And also, on the other hand, it also provides a lot of data for us to do things. One, use it for risk management on the credit side, right? You know, out of the loan portfolio. But also, it allows us to better understand, you know, all the inflows, outflows of the investors and better manage, you know, what are the liquidity requirements within Go and Grow. Now, second aspect is that, you know, with Go and Grow, we have designed the product so that it can provide, you know, instant liquidity. That instant liquidity is not guaranteed. However, we use the sort of highest industry standards to you know, manage how we look at liquidity inside of Go and Grow. And as a result, we've been able to, out of the 74 months that Go and Grow has already existed, we've been able to provide instant liquidity in 70 months out of the 74. So only at the start of the COVID crisis, there were actually, you know, you had partial payouts, which is also designed into Go and Grow so that when there is a situation where there's not enough liquidity, it doesn't just crash or run down, sure, like you would have, you know, a traditional bank do, but there's a mechanism in place where investors start getting daily increments of the money. So, you know, so these are, you know, the first two pillars. And third, you know, on top of it all, you know, we are running that concept on now, 16 years of experience of continuously going through different crises, to starting out with financial crisis. So, you know, what does that make is, you know, Go and Grow as a product is, in our opinion, in a completely different category when you look at the sort of peer-to-peer lending products, right? So obviously you can compare every different type of an kind of investment opportunity on the market, and you can say that, oh, end of the day, it's only money coming in and money coming out. But on a conceptual level, you know, the risk diversification, the stable returns, and the liquidity makes it very different than the peer-to-peer lending products, where you kind of, like, typically either you invest by project or, you know, you big loans, etc. So it's a different sort of mechanism. And that's why we don't really, when we look at competition, we don't benchmark against peer-to-peer lenders anymore. And that's been the case for the last 5-6 years. When we look at where our customers invest their money, then only a fraction of them actually invest their money in peer-to-peer lending platforms, right? So the you know, bulk of customers we have today, they either have their investments in, you know, obviously guaranteed deposits, some in, you know, kind of like insurance products, ETFs. Crypto is actually, you know, a meaningful part, but not huge, still around like maybe 10-15. And then you see that, you know, the peer-to-peer lending investments actually make up like maybe 5-6% of the total portfolio. So when we now go trace back to, okay, you know, why we've actually designed the product the way we have designed it, is that we've done it, you know, not trying to compete with other peer-to-peer lenders, but we've tried to design a product that our customers actually want. And it's been successful. But it puts us into a different, you know, category than, you know, maybe some of the other platforms that you're following. And I'm not saying anything good or bad about those products, but they are different.
Sure. Now, I would argue, you know, just because, you know, your investor base might come from different sources or that don't have anything to do with you know, traditional peer-to-peer lending, if that's the case, ultimately it's the product that defines, like, let's say, which market you're kind of operating in. And factors, as you mentioned, like liquidity, I'm sure, you know, there's offers in the market, we don't need to mention that, offer a certain liquidity, let's say, be it higher or a bit lower. The underlying assets are consumer loans. Most of the platforms operating in a not regulated environment, some do obviously. You have a regulated licensing entity in Estonia, but the platform itself is not regulated. So it's very easy to make a comparison or to put Bondora in the same box or, let's say, same category as many other platforms. But, you know, we can leave, you know, this aside from now. You know, if you want, agree to disagree, but still answer kindly, like, who do you see then as your direct competitors right now?
So, you know, on the previous point, I think, you know, there's... I think the decision on how people compare us is eventually with our customers, you know, and the people in the market. So
I would say it's the product, not the investors.
No, in that sense that it's the customers themselves who decide how they compare it, right? And that's what, you know, we are focused on what our customers' needs are, not what other, you know, products that can be considered similar are doing, right? So we are 100% focused on what our customers want out of the product, and we've designed, you know, based on that. So that's where, you know, we're drawing our inspiration from. That's what we want to sort of, like, you know, where we want to be successful at, you know, delivering on the expectations of our customers. And our customers expect those, you know, things that
but
are
as any other platform would do, right?
Steady. I can't comment on any other platform, right? So, you know, once again, I think we're, you know, the stable return, the high risk diversification and the liquidity sets Bondora apart. Obviously, you know, you may disagree, but out of that, so there's, when we look at where our customers invest in, right, and how they compare and where do they kind of like really compare us against, is the sort of main parts of their portfolio, right, which are, you know, more traditional securities and more traditional sort of products rather than, you know, the marketplaces.
So you're talking about stocks, funds, ETFs, or
More stable income, you know, opportunities, right? So we look at deposits, we look at you know, term deposits, we look at sort of like ETFs, you know, more stable income, stable sort of return products rather than volatile ones. So we see that for our customer base, stability and predictability of the returns is one key factor. So out of our customer base, the sort of, like, you know, once again, the stock investor, like a traditional stock investor, active stock investor, is not a persona that's quite heavily represented. Yes, people have money in crypto, etc., and other sort of parts, but our customers are more, you know, looking at steady income. Overall, we can't, like, because of regulatory reasons, we can't, you know, openly compare ourselves with, like, bank deposits, etc., right?
Because they are... deposit insurance?
Yeah, exactly, because given there's a differences in you know, the guarantees and different advertising rules, then we can't publicly sort of go out and, you know, compare one-on-one, you know, with deposits and certain ETFs. But when we're designing the products... You know, so if you want to look at how we look at internally, then when we're designing the products and thinking of, okay, what value propositions actually matter and what our customers want, and these are the categories that we look at, right? And that's why I can't now, like, make one-on-one comparisons with any of them, because I'm just not allowed to do that.
Sure. But at the same time, I believe it's, you know, you put yourself in a position where you just try to define your own position within the market, and as a consequence, you don't feel like to justify, okay, now how do we stack up against other peer-to-peer platforms? Because you explain, like, okay, we see ourselves in a totally different environment, but at the same time, the environment you see yourself in, you can't openly, you know, make comparisons because you don't fulfill certain criteria, as of yet, at least. So I think that's a kind of also unique position you try to put yourself in, you know, not taking away any credit from, let's say, the long track record you have and the history and the returns you delivered in the past. But at the same time, I feel like it's it leaves a lot of room to question why Bondora acts a certain way at times, I believe. But let's just continue and see. Go and Grow was mentioned now a couple of times. We can go a bit deeper into this product. Before, one question. How transparent would you consider the Bondora business to be?
I mean, when we look at the information we publish and is available, then, you know, Bondora was the first, you know, platform I know in continental Europe that actually made its sort of data stack publicly available, you know, both as on download as through APIs. We were also the first one who actually opened up the API, you know, kind of trading and investment. And those cornerstones are still there, you know, from, I think we did it in 2014 or 2016. So we've been, you know, open from day one, when we, not almost, from day one, for the past 10 years. So I don't really see that there's anything more we can do. Obviously, we also publish like blog posts, etc. But these are already more sort of like, you know, smaller overview pieces that are more relevant to our customer base. But at the same time, all the sort of underlying data is there. There's also, you know, besides Go and Grow, there's the ability to invest over the API. So if you have like programming skills, and I know at one point of the time people had different sort of like, you know, tools available that they were sharing or, you know, selling for our investors that allowed them to sort of, you know, utilize the API. But that level of transparency and sort of like access to data and access to sort of granular, you know, bidding is something that, you know, is quite, still quite unique. But I think, you know, quite a lot of players have tried to mimic it. But when you look at underlying data, then I don't think that all the underlying data is as detailed and transparent as it is with Bondora, because with a number of places where you can actually download the data, the information that's available to the investors doesn't reflect actual underlying loans. But that is, once again, you know, something I'm not going to go super deep about in which platforms, but there's a lot of platforms that have created, like, taken a loan and then transformed it into something else. So the information that the customer sees about those loan claims, like, okay, this is like 10%, this is 11%, actually has no relation to what is the underlying loan that may be issued in Georgia with 70% interest rates, right? So, you know, I think overall, in general in the market, you know, Bondora has defined the transparency rules, right? And there is a number of, you know, great players in the market who are matching it, right? And then there's a lot that, you know, maybe seemingly have a lot of visibility, but, you know, if you actually dig into the numbers and then you look at, okay, what are the actual originations, you know, behind, then it's not the case. But once more, like, we don't really try to compare ourselves, you know, platform by platform like that. We don't see that this segment is where we're, like, you know, really competing in. But, you know, just, you know, from our perspective, we defined those rules and transparency, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, everyone is just catching up with what was said there. And a lot of players have done a great job of catching up of what was the sort of, you know, maybe standard we defined a while ago. For us, it's just important to maintain this part, you know, open and publicly. But it's, you know, the public posts are more, you know, then tuned to what, on the level of granularity that we think that the general customers are interested in. But still, everything is still open.
I'm surprised you didn't mention the annual reports, which, you know, is also not very common, at least in the peer-to-peer space, which are audited on a regular basis by, I think, Bondora's KPMG. So that's a very good reporting standard. In terms of transparency at Bondora, you know, Go and Grow having a switch now, obviously the question, how many assets does Bondora manage at the moment within the Go and Grow product?
So first of all, Bondora doesn't manage assets. So we're not a fund, you know, nor Go and Grow is a fund. So given, you know, this is not the fund nor a deposit product, then we have a number of regulatory rules that apply to our marketing and communication, which in essence state that whatever we do and communicate, we cannot in any way portray the products as if they're like a fund or as if their deposit product. And we do a lot of work to make sure we don't, you know, break those sort of guidelines. Because, and that is something that in some parts forces us to be more wrong with words than we can actually, you know, in an ideal situation be. So when it comes to detailed numbers about, okay, what is the total amount of money invested, you know, exactly by investors and etc., then, you know, there's no Go and Grow fund as such, right? There's no Go and Grow balance sheet that we manage. And therefore, given we're not a fund, we cannot actually imply and state and publish numbers that would, you know, somehow portray Bondora differently than the actual product is.
I'm not sure how you go against certain regulatory laws by pointing out the assets you have under management from the company. I mean, there's Estonian platforms as well in the peer-to-peer space. Let's say, let's name Income Marketplace, that also publicly share the development of their assets they have under management. So how does it differ for Bondora having the same jurisdiction?
So when you look at the data we publish, then, you know, everything we publish under the sort of like criminal loan book and the overview we provide is everything we can actually publish, right? So we don't know what are the exact jurisdictions or rules that other competitors are following, but we have quite strict rules internally defined based on the laws we know apply to us and the laws that we are destined not to sort of in any way kind of break, that set and define how we communicate about Go and Grow and what we communicate about that. It's also the like words we used and etc. So it's quite technical. I cannot comment what, you know, what are the things that other lenders follow, because it depends on, you know, what discussions they've had with their regulators and everything around that.
So once again, just to confirm, it's not an internal policy, it's external rules. But you're not regulated by an Estonian entity, are you?
So
aside from your lender in Estonia.
So basically, like, in order not to fall under, you know, the constructs, you know, given Go and Grow is not a fund, Go and Grow is not a guaranteed deposit, then you have a lot of rules that are coming from those regulations that basically define, you know, what wording you can use, what communication you can use if you're, you know, that or that type of entity. Which means that if you're not, right, then you need to make sure that you're not using any communication that would imply for a retail customer that this is now a fund product or this is now a, you know, deposit product. We've done a lot of surveys among our customer base and have ensured that, you know, all our customers understand that this is not a fund product and this is not a guaranteed deposit and the capital is at risk, meaning that whilst we've been able to deliver 6.75% return for the last 6 years and we have very strong internal sort of mechanisms and stress testing and forecasting in place that allow us to sort of predict, you know, 10 years into the future and adjust our policies, you know, today to the level that is necessary to ensure that we can deliver the target return also 10 years into the future, then we cannot in any case imply that A, you know, the return is guaranteed. We cannot in any way kind of like, you know, seemingly imply that it's somehow to do with a deposit product or any other regulated product. So, you know, as you said, so that the kind of the positioning and the setup of Go and Grow gives us certain, you know, limits as such, right, that we need to follow. And, you know, in that sense, they're internally defined, you know, within compliance to make sure that we don't, you know, have problems when it comes to sort of like, you know, any rules on advertising of you know, securities, deposits, and sure, other regulated funds. So it's like, it's quite complex, you know, set of rules. I don't know if and what rules are applied to the different platforms that you're kind of like mentioning and how much they have actually looked into this. But we've been in this business now for, you know, since 2008, right? We've had a lot of conversations with different regulators across all of Europe and also beyond. And, you know, it's quite, let's say, hard, you know, and hard work to maintain a strong understanding of what you need to do in order to sort of like really, really operate. And as you get bigger, then those rules get tougher. You know, as a very small startup, then, you know, people don't maybe really care. But being in this business for that long of time, and we've had a lot of those conversations, and there's a lot of rules that we need to comply with, right?
Okay.
It also applies, for example, in our consumer lending businesses, that a number of the things that we today have to follow are things that are applied to banks and rules that weren't applied to us, you know, maybe 2016 or 17. So there's two trends, you know, right now in Europe. First of all, regulations are getting stricter on anything related to financial services. And second part is that, you know, more and more of the rules that, you know, in some cases used to be applied only to banks are now applied to sort of non-banks as well.
I'm just personally confused why this would be, you know, I don't know the specific rules that or the compliance that applies in this case that would prevent you from stating those numbers publicly. But even then, I would just boldly assume the way you have disclaimers for interest or the interest is not guaranteed for Go and Grow. The return is not returned. Yeah, exactly. Thanks. The return is not guaranteed or capital is at risk, you know, that why wouldn't you just put in a disclaimer saying this is the assets we manage at the moment within this product, with a disclaimer we hereby, you know, acknowledge this is not a fund actually that we're having. Yeah. This is just for transparency purpose for our investor base to have a better understanding about, you know, the product and then ultimately also the risk profile of the product. So that would be my logic.
Look, I mean, you know, all the things we today publish are based on, you know, what we've gotten back from our customers, that, you know, the information at the level of granularity that's needed. At the same time, the loan data tape is 100% public, right? So anyone who has a lot of deep interest into these actually can get like quite granular data from there. So I think we've kind of like covered it in both sides. And right now, we have not seen a need to sort of like adjust, you know. I think the strong data tape is there to support any very detailed, you know, request without us having to sort of add anything on top to the day-to-day customer.
With the logic behind the assets under management, is it the same one that applies for not publishing data on the current net return of the Go and Grow loan portfolio?
Yes, because Go and Grow, it applies to all of those levels basically, right? So Go and Grow, you know, net return is, so, you know, just to kind of talk about the design of Go and Grow again. So Go and Grow is designed so that, you know, all excess return, effectively over 6.75%, kind of is held back as reserves, right, to cushion constantly through times where, you know, as actually returns go up and down. So historically, we've been able to deliver 6.75% over the past 6 years. And what we do internally is that we, you know, as I mentioned before, we have different sort of risk management processes in place to forecast the future of those portfolios, you know, 10 years into the future. And then we see, okay, if and what do we need to change today in either pricing, risk levels, I don't know, recoveries, etc., in the operational business to ensure that Go and Grow return can be sustainable, right? Once again, we cannot say it's guaranteed, but it can be sustainable, you know, throughout the term. So whilst we cannot state that the return is guaranteed in any way, then internally we're doing everything, you know, humanly and technically possible to ensure that, you know, not only in the 6 years past up until now, but also into the, you know, long future we have ahead of us, we're able to deliver that. There's a lot of investment going into that, but the sort of like technical disclosures around these things we're not going to make about exactly how we do it on a daily level and, you know, everything that goes into sort of the on the inputs. So it applies on, you know, that also to sort of like in terms of like liquidity, for example, right? So when we look at sort of like liquidity inside of Go and Grow, then, you know, we use the principles applied in the industry to other, you know, similar institutions, right? And then based on these, we have designed the way how constantly we look at, you know, the liquidity inside Go and Grow. And, you know, given we've from already almost day one, I think, applied those principles, we've been able to deliver instant liquidity, although it's not guaranteed, you know, in 70 months out of 74, which is our great achievement.
Well, let's stick to the return 1 second, because still on the, let's say, general statistics page on Bondora, we can see there's a net return pointed out with 6.4% at the moment. Is this all loans from
2009?
And this implies, so the assets that went into Portfolio Pro, Portfolio Manager.
It implies everything, yeah.
Including Go and Grow?
It implies all loans. It implies all loans. So it implies all loans that we've issued ever throughout Go and Grow, and not only from Go and Grow, but, you know, individual investments, APIs, Portfolio Manager, Portfolio Pro, every single country. It also implies, you know, sort of like institutional investors that we used to work with who kind of buy specific blocks of loans. It's basically all loans.
Mm. All right. Obviously, then the question is, how sustainable do you think the return of 6.75% is when over the span of 16 years your general performance is below that mark?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I said, the return that's there is calculated over 16 years, right? And we started Bondora, Go and Grow 6 years ago, I think. And, you know, a bulk of the activity in Go and Grow and the investors have, you know, basically, you know, invested in the past years. So when we look at also when we started versus where we are now, then we have, by now have invested, you know, into hundreds of thousands of loans that continuously allow us to fine-tune the credit models, fine-tune the way we price, to fine-tune our operations. So, you know, as every day goes past, the higher, you know, we can get the margin, you know, on the loans that we issue. However, of course, like when we talk about the margin, you know, on each loan issued, then there's also the factor of, okay, what is competition doing, you know, because you need to price the sort of loans from the consumer borrower's perspective as well competitively. But as we get better at understanding the risk levels and everything around that, we can always make sure that every loan we book has the necessary sort of like margin to deliver the 6.75% to investors. And I said, you know, we feel quite confident, but we do a lot of work on risk management side on ensuring that we're able to do that sustainably 10 years into the future, right? So we're not looking at like some short period of time, but we're actually simulating 10 years into the future on understanding, okay, if and what we need to do today, you know, to ensure that the returns that we want to deliver to the Go and Grow customers are sustainable for that timeline.
Hmm. Obviously, I see it a bit twisted, because on one side, Bondora itself as a company seems very, let's say, financially stable. But at the same time, those indicators bring up or lead to a feeling of, okay, Bondora apparently has certain struggles if you look at the statistics when it comes to the performance of the loan portfolio. Seeing also having, you know, a lot of investors that had negative returns in the past, and then how to trust a product like Bondora Go and Grow, which in a nutshell is, you know, a black box, very hard to understand from the outside in terms of how many assets are actually underlying there. You know, you sub-communicate a few numbers, 100,000 of loans and here and there, but what is the actual return? How big is that liquidity buffer in the end? As you mentioned, is also something you can't properly comment on, to understand like when, at which point might, you know, investors run into the risk of partial payouts again, or, you know, because you're selling this product very much on liquidity, but not having an understanding about how the actual underlying assets are performing makes it very difficult to understand for investors how much they can trust this product outside of just arguments, okay, there's a long track record and you delivered reliable most of the times in the past. So how do you, you know, want to deal with this this situation? Or do you believe, like many investors, are not that concerned about it at all?
No, I mean, when we survey our customers, then, you know, almost everyone always comes back that they understand that their capital is at risk at Pandora. They don't look at this as like, you know, some kind of a guaranteed deposit. So when we look at, you know, what our investors understand, that yes, they understand there's risk involved with Pandora, right? So obviously, you know, I'm not sure if they're, you know, concerned or not concerned, but they're diligent that, you know, there's investments risks associated, right? But the stable net return and the liquidity they've been able to access is a very strong, you know, value proposition compared to many other alternatives on the market, right? So, you know, now looking at, you know, if you say that, okay, you know, we've been able to deliver 6.4%, you know, annualized return over 16 years, then if you look at even traditional products, also in terms of stocks and bonds, etc., then, you know, through that 5 crises, it's actually a very strong return, you know, return. Now, obviously, when we look at Go and Grow today, then our target return is 6.75%, which means that, you know, we are constantly investing and have done so for many years now into risk management, into pricing, and into the sort of credit collections and all of those operations that are necessary to be able to deliver that return to investors, right? So, you know, the loan portfolios today are diversified across many markets. You know, Estonia and Finland, you know, we've been operating for many years, and these make up the bulk. Netherlands is growing quite steadily, but, you know, as it's a new country, we're also sort of constantly, every week, basically looking at the risk indicators and adjusting for it. Latvia, we just launched, but Latvia, you know, will scale up only next year, because once again, we're going to take it much more slowly than we did in the past, right? Because if we look at in the past, then when new markets came online, we kind of like scaled them much faster. Now we have a very kind of like slow growth profile there. So we have that part, plus, you know, we've invested now, I think the risk team is, you know, 30-40 people today that daily deal with all aspects of the sort of credit risks, you know, from you know, pricing the loans, from how we issue. I mean, I think you wanted to go through the process as well later on. So I've taken our sort of credit policy with me, you know, how we issue the loans, how we price the loans, how we collect the loans, how we go to court. You know, we have very strong today processes in each country in place, how do we take cases to court. So we've invested a lot of money and we continue to invest a lot of money into credit risk management and pricing and everything related to that to be able to deliver 6.75%. Of course, internally, in order to do that, we are aiming for much, you know, higher IRRs on the underlying loans to be able to deliver that, right? And those higher IRRs are not sort of that, you know, the interest rates are higher, but actually the net return targets are higher so that the risk buffer is strong enough. So I think the track record we have, plus, you know, the principles and policies we have in place today, and also actually the data to support it, is a very strong foundation for, you know, customers to believe that we're able to deliver on our promises. And I can just rest assured say that whilst we cannot guarantee, you know, even the principal as such, then internally we're doing everything humanly and technically possible to not only guarantee, or not, I could say, I can't say guarantee, but not only to sort of ensure that, you know, we're able to sort of safeguard the principal, but we're there to safeguard the return as well. And all of our processes and policies and the sort of internal tools we built are designed to be able to do that looking 10 years into the future.
I have a practical question. Now, lately in March, you had like a birthday campaign where, you know, it was allowed to deposit a couple more funds on Pandora and Pandora Go and Grow in particular. Now you attracted 31 million of funds. At the same time, I think it was March, April, you just were able to facilitate around 15 million of euros in your lending markets. So first question here, how satisfied are you generally now with the demand from the lending markets that you operate in?
You mean from the borrowers?
Yes.
So in terms of lending market demand overall, then, you know, demand is around 50 times higher than the volume. So the
okay.
So the volume of loan applications we process each month is, you know, quite significant, but only a few percentage points of this volume is actually what we book. And this is because of all the risk rules and the sort of return targets we've set ourselves.
Okay, understood.
So Estonia and Finland are still the biggest markets. Netherlands is growing quite well. The risk indicators are super well, you know, there now. Latvia, we're, you know, going to continue relatively small volumes throughout the next 12 months or so, or slowly growing volumes. And then we're looking to also bring in three new countries over the next 18 months and still considering, you know, regarding Spain. So I don't think that demand is an issue, but it's more, you know, we're very diligent to make sure that we're able to guarantee, you know, the returns, and therefore, you know, we need to make sure that all the loans we book actually match our risk appetite, match our return appetite as well. Right now, as part of, you know, I'll walk you through the entire process of how we underwrite. So there's actually quite a number of steps, you know, in between what we need to do.
Separate event.
Yeah.
Separate interview. All right, thanks for the answer. That's interesting to hear also the ratio you have from the supply you get from borrowers and then the actual acceptance rate. So that's factor of 50 is quite impressive. Now, how do you balance attracting new funds? You know, obviously within Go and Grow that you can't facilitate at this point in time, but yet you're still obliged, you know, to pay 6.75% interest return. How do you balance with funds that are not in use actually, yet you need to pay something back to investors?
Sure. I mean, when we look at, you know, the targets we've set when we, you know, issue loans, when we look at, you know, what is the sort of part of the return that is needed to be able to deliver on the promises or the targets we've set for Go and Grow, then internally we are actually looking at higher return targets. That also accounts for that there is a certain amount of capital that's basically being, you know, just sitting, you know. So that is accounted into pricing already. So when we issue loan, we already account for the fact that there's a certain liquidity level that we need to maintain. And the level of liquidity level we need to maintain, we've designed this based on sort of rules that are applied to, you know, similar traditional products. So how much liquidity and how we look at the inflows, outflows and everything around that. And those things basically determine, you know, on you know, if we are more active or less active with investor engagement. Now, given we're now, you know, operated the product for 6 years and there's a lot of investors, then we have also quite a lot of statistics around investors. So we're quite well able to predict also, like, okay, you know, what level of activity or you know, downscaling our activity or engagement is necessary to maintain a balance. But, you know, with overall with every business, you kind of like need to balance your inventory and your sales and sort of like the suppliers. So it's you know, in some cases, it's, I don't want to simplify, it's no different than like a, you know, a restaurant we would need to do, right? In our case, there's just a lot of data and mathematics that goes into understanding, okay, what is it that we now need to do? Like, you know, how much do we need to accelerate in terms of investor engagement? Okay, now we need to, you know, pull back. So you also can see this from, like, you know, somewhat our activity levels of our engagement with different parties. So whilst in one side we would like to be constantly, you know, on, then that would create a situation that sort of the underlying loans need to, you know, deliver higher and higher and higher return, you know, to cover for the part of the funds that are in cash and that that belong to the investors.
Okay, Can you talk about how Go and Grow stacks up against Go and Grow Unlimited? Mm-hmm. So how many users are utilizing each, let's say, return level? How do they compare both?
Sure. With each other? So, you know, overall, I mean, the main difference between Go and Grow and Go and Grow Unlimited today is that, you know, within Go and Grow Unlimited, you know, there's no like amount that you can invest per month, but therefore the return is capped not at 6.75% but at 4%, right? And you know, since some time ago now, we've kind of like in terms of user experience, you know, combined those products so that the customers don't have to move the money around here and there, so they can send effectively, you know, a larger amount, you know, to Pandora. And then each month we actually take, you know, the part that's, you know, allowed to invest into Go and Grow, we take it from Go and Grow Unlimited. So if you have two products, then they actually act as one, right? So we constantly automatically balance to make sure that your money is not sitting at the 4% return if it could be, you know, earning money at the 6.75% return. And I believe that like this level is something that, you know, a lot of also traditional investment products don't offer, that we actually like upgrade the return on our customers on our own each month, you know, to deliver them a better experience. And that's basically sort of like the main difference. So now around 10%, so the number of customers you have money Go and Grow Unlimited is larger, but in terms of like, you know, let's say capital invested, then at the moment it's 10% on Go and Grow Unlimited and 90% on Go and Grow. But it kind of like shifts every month because you have like, you know, inflows, some of the inflows first land in Go and Grow Unlimited, and then at the end of the month we kind of rebalance constantly. Because there's like, you know, broadly, you know, two types of investors, you know, we're seeing. So, you know, ones are that actually making, you know, you can see kind of like they've set up more or less a recurring payment each month. You know, more or less the money comes more or less the same amount, more or less in the same day each month. And then you have people who make like a bigger, you know, investment.
One-time investment.
Kind of like one-time investment or like once every year or, you know, a few times at different parts when they have a liquidity event. Like, I don't know, they've gotten a bonus or something like that. So, you know, these are the two different types. So for the ones who make, you know, one big investment, so the money would first flow into Go and Grow Unlimited, you know, and the €1,000 goes to Go and Grow, and then each month, you know, the money is moved from one another. So, you know, effectively, as we have designed the product, you know, so that it automatically gives the benefit to the investors, you know, by moving money from one tier to another when they're eligible, then, you know, you would have a situation that there's a constant, you know, growth on the Go and Grow tier and more money constantly flowing from Go and Grow Unlimited to Go and Grow, because this is how we've just designed it. But for those investors making large amounts, you know, once every now and then, these are typically the money that goes through there.
Sure. But understanding like roughly 10% of the capital is deployed to Unlimited, and that's a good idea, I think, for investors to understand like how they both stack up against each other. I wanted to have a couple questions about the growth. You mentioned three new markets within the next 18 months. Now, in the past, you know, we heard similar, let's say, plans and ideas from Pandora, which I think you were sometimes a little bit behind. Another thing was, I remember a Q&A session of yours 2 years ago, pretty much 2 years ago, where you said, like, within a very short period of time, you want to have 1 million of active customers. And I think throughout the last 2 years, I think the net gain was around 40,000 new investors, which is also not too bad, but obviously it's far off from what your ambition was at the time. Why do you think Pandora, let's say, failed at attracting investors at a larger scale in a faster pace than you anticipated?
So first of all, when we look at our, you know, targets we've set for customers overall, then we look at all, you know, borrowers and investors together.
Ah, okay, you won. Okay.
So we look at, you know, everyone in Pandora as a customer. So that sort of like puts that aside a bit.
So you managed to have 1 million customers, including borrowers?
No. You know, that's there was a target at one moment. You know, we don't kind of like keep this as a flag anymore, simply because, you know, the number of customer growth is not the best sort of North Star we have, you know, to date. So we've decided to, you know, slightly look at the, you know, business from a different angle. So we've internally not following that target anymore. However, you know, getting to 1 million customers is a kind of, let's say, an output of the plans we have anyway, right? But it's not a target on its own anymore, which was the case maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So we've got to, like, you know, as I said, as we're kind of like maturing and transforming into a bank, the way we look at the business and the way we look at how to grow the business is constantly changing as well. So, you know, when we're looking at the business today, then, you know, we are, you know, really focused on kind of like really increasing the sort of like the size of the performing loan portfolio. And in order to do that, then you basically have, you know, let's say broadly 3 levers. You know, one is that you lend more in the existing countries, right? Be more active, get a bigger market share. Second is that you add new geographies. And then the third is that you kind of like expand your, you know, share of the wallet within those existing countries, but through new products. And today, when we look at our growth, then, you know, we are today focused predominantly on the first 2 levers. So, which is increasing our market share in the existing countries with the existing products, and then, you know, launching new countries. Evidently, at one stage, there may be a case where we look at, okay, you know, are there any alternative credit products that we want to go into? We have a couple of products that are in sort of like, you know, let's say MVP or pilot phase for already some time. But we're not scaling them. You know, we're still focusing predominantly on the core product and making the core product experience, you know, much better for the underlying consumers, both on the investor side as well as, you know, when we look at the credit business. But the new geographies is going to be a strong foundation part for near-term growth. If you look at now in the past, 18 months, then we've launched Netherlands and Latvia, which is, you know, when we look at long-term history, then I think the last market we launched before Netherlands was in 2014. So we had a long pause in between. And obviously during that long pause in between, we changed the business completely, right? Because in 2014, 15, 16, and these are all the periods that are also sort of like in, when you look at the statistics, then, you know, we still had kind of this purely like a market maker approach. And we started to change this approach somewhere in 2016. And that meant that, you know, we needed to kind of like better invest in the infrastructure in both in terms of the technology as well as with the talent we have to be able to run the business across Europe. You know, now having launched 2 countries in 18 months, we are working on another 3, you know, which will roll out in the next 18 months as well. And then, you know, we'll see if the scope of the markets is already big enough that we can kind of slow down in terms of adding geographies. But the main reason why we're, you know, quite strongly, you know, investing in this area is that, you know, having now the experience we've gained over these 16 years, we see that, you know, to launch new countries successfully, and successfully not like, you know, tick in a box, we have like done it, but successfully in terms of that to make it, you know, profitable, you know, for everyone involved, you actually need to go slow, right? Unless you acquire someone, but this is not the strategy we're taking right now. So we're not looking at M&A activities. So rather we're looking at organic growth, and therefore we have a, you know, stage sort of scaling plan where we're very slowly, like, you know, I think in the first month the target is like 25 loans and something like that, where we're slowly picking up, right? And that's quite, I think, you know, thematically different than the approach we had, you know, 2013, 2014, when we launched in Finland and Spain.
Mm. Okay, yeah. Elaborate answer on the customer base now. So if we reduce it, let's say from the target you had back then with 1 million customers, to the investor base you have right now, 225, 230, something like this, 30,000. Just a quick question: if you have that number top of your head, how many of those are active investors in the moment? If we define it as, you know, have made investments in the last 6 or 12 months.
I don't have it at hand. I don't have it at hand.
Okay.
It really typically like fluctuates. One reason is that, you know, the type of the product GoandGrow is, it allows you to be quite steady. Like, you know, there's some people who just put money in and then they, you know, they're investing for the next 5, 6, 10 years, right? So there's another lot of like active movement. And once again, there's other people that put money on a continuous level.
Hmm. All right, then let's switch to Portfolio Pro and Portfolio Manager. If it's still in your head, I know it's been discontinued for a long time. It was, I think, Q1, Q2 last year when you stopped issuing new loans for those products. Back then, the let's say underlying communication was there's a lack of demand for both products. I would like to challenge this argumentation that you had back in the day by saying, you know, there was events in the past where it's also like I had an interview with Matt when he was still with Bondora. That was towards the end of 2020. And he said you adjusted a bit the logic of how you attribute new loans and you do it more looking at where's the active customer base at the moment. So if there's more users at GoandGrow, you obviously facilitate more loans for this product respectively. And this led to a change or to a transition where more of 90% of new loans have been issued for GoandGrow then as a consequence, which ultimately had the few investors that, you know, were fond of using Portfolio Manager or Portfolio Pro to face cash drag issues, dropping out from the product because there was no use for them anymore. So in a way, you kind of like facilitated this lack of demand in a slightly different way to only focus now on the GoandGrow main product line. Was it a forced exit from Bondora's side, and do you think you could have maybe still kept room for those products for even if it was just a smaller margin, 10-15% of investors that wanted to use the auto invest version on Bondora?
So I said, you know, we're trying to design our products and our sort of like product strategy based on, you know, our existing customers. And, you know, when you end up in a situation that 97% of your customers or 98% of your customers, you know, use GoandGrow, then, you know, eventually as a business you need to make a decision on how long do you keep other products, you know, that all require technically basically the same amount of support, setup and maintenance. How long do you keep them actually like running? And it's kind of a hard decision because, you know, I have personally as a product manager created, you know, both Portfolio Pro probably in like, when was it, maybe 2013, who knows, like a while ago, and Portfolio Manager was probably in 2015.
Sorry, can I just interrupt one second, because you said like I just want to comment on the 97-98%. That was really towards the end of the road of Portfolio Pro, Portfolio Manager. I think at the time when you were revising your logic, it was still in the range of, you know, 85-90%. So, you know, considering the user base you had at the time,
I think it's
more substantial than putting only 2% of our investors wanted to use this product.
So at the time when, you know, we didn't feel it's fair that it was, you know, 85% of the customers, but at that moment of time, because how the rules were set up, and that was like really 4 years ago, so, you know, I don't know exactly what the rules were, but how the rules were set up was that, you know, the customers inside Portfolio Pro and Portfolio Manager got a much bigger share of the sort of loans that, you know, should have been attributed, which meant that there were a lot of, you know, kind of, let's say, very large, you know, investors there who were taking a much bigger share of the loans that equally, you know, smaller investors and sort of like GoandGrow investors could have taken. So, you know, we have decided already back then that, you know, when we're designing products and the setups, we want to make sure that kind of like you know, everyone, you know, with 5 or 25 euros has the ability to come in and invest, right? That they're not sort of like pushed back in some queues because of, you know, larger investors. And, you know, at that moment of time, we decided to start trailing the sort of or limiting the amount of volume that goes into one or another product based on how many users are behind. And one moment, you know, you can say that, okay, like what was a chicken and what was an egg, right? And, you know, we can probably debate this and maybe ChatGPT can give you an answer much faster. But in this logic, we see already a continuous decline in those products. We saw that our, you know, bulk of our customers want Go and Grow, you know, with the diversification it provides, the steady returns it provides, and the sort of like liquidity provides, plus the ability to just like, you know, you put in 5 euros, 10, 25 euros, next month 25, it still works the same way as regardless the amounts being put in. So it was a business decision, right? You know, personally, I think, you know, these were, for me and the people who actually created those products, more emotional because, you know, we kind of had to actually, you know, at one moment, what was like now 18 months ago or 12 months ago, actually said that, okay, like now, you know, we reached a point that it's not feasible anymore to maintain it. But we've, you know, making a decision to make sure that the API, that sort of infrastructure, that transparency infrastructure that kind of like was running under the EFTs, this remains open. But we're not going to maintain those granular products on our own behalf, because it's created also setup that, you know, with now with 16 years, the user experience had gotten really, really bulky, right? And there's still, you know, quite some work we need to do internally to kind of like, you know, simplify and make sure that all the features there are relevant. Because the fact that, you know, we're even today combining in the same user experience, you know, the experience for Go and Grow customers, and then there's legacy customers who have portfolios but don't invest anymore, and then there's API customers, it kind of like technically made it all quite sort of cumbersome. So we decided, you know, to take those two products off. We have now actively Go and Grow and we have API. And, you know, separately in terms of UI, we need to see then how to best create an experience that, you know, that the Go and Grow investors plus the legacy investors who have a portfolio still and API ones, you know, all get the great customer experience. Mm.
How much of that decision also came from, let's say, negative experiences from investors that actually with their facilitated investments through those auto-invest portfolios, you know, achieved a negative return? We can see it on the generous statistics. It varies here and there, but let's say 15% of investors, you know, having a negative return on Bodora. So how much was attributed to, let's say, avoid also negative PR or, let's say, negative reviews in that regard to sunset the product, as you called
it? That wasn't really the driver, predominantly because portfolio manager itself were not sources on their own of any negative returns. Other than in situations where the customers really defined, you know, certain strategies that were not sustainable. However, overall, you know, we've already for the many past years, you know, set up our internal risk management so to make sure that on kind of like even a subset portfolio level, you know, all of the sort of portfolios, you know, make a return. Of course, that means that the portfolios itself need to be at least, you know, N100 loans, right? You can't, you know, have risk diversification of 10. You know, if you look at Go and Grow, there's hundreds of thousands of loans there. So, like, getting that level of diversification is basically impossible in Portfolio Pro and Portfolio Manager at the time. You know, an API is kind of doable if you, you know, really invest in everyone. But the main source of the problem when it came to sort of negative returns was actually secondary market trading, right? Because what happened was that, you know, people looked at, oh, you know, things are not going well, or I need the cash, and then they put the loans on sale on secondary market. Given the secondary market, you know, isn't liquid, then, you know, any transactions that were done on super low discounts. So basically what happened was that people locked in, you know, huge losses, you know, and this like 10 or 15% sort of IRR, you know, on an investor level is not what we want to sort of like achieve and see. So, whilst this is not the source and it was not considered, I think, but it was more about the secondary market trading that that triggered, you know, losses on those customers. You know, because, you know, the return on every loan actually comes through holding it, you know, through the life cycle, rather than just coming in and then going out. And at the same time, on the secondary market, like, there's, you know, people who made their, like, you know, hundreds of percents of IRR by basically buying up loans on sale and then just, you know, keeping them. So all in all, the portfolio management portfolio, you know, Pro versus Sunset, you know, only because of the low user base compared to other products, right? I understand there was a big fan base behind, and, you know, like, you know, it was quite emotional to sunset the products because, you know, I think personally, or we were still as a active product manager, you know, around those things. But any sort of like the review topics, etc., weren't, you know, considered there, but because the kind of ultimate source for these things was trading on the secondary market. And understanding that this trading on the secondary market was actually the where people kind of like the locked in the losses.
All right, last chapter, let's now close the circle and get back to the banking license. Now, you mentioned, like, within the next 5 years, you want to have or obtain that pan-European banking license. What's the benefit for a company like Bondora to go this way?
Sure. I mean, there's two benefits, right? So first benefit is that it allows us to start offering guaranteed deposits. You know, probably predominantly term deposits, but maybe, like, you know, those current accounts in the future, but at this stage we're not thinking about this. And this is a product that our investor base has actually, our customer base has already asked us a lot, because, you know, as I said before, you know, where our customers currently keep their money, you know, a big part of it is in term deposits in banks, right? And 2 years ago, it was earning like 1-2% there. Okay, now it went up, but it's coming down again. And even for unless people were super actively like looking for good deals in smaller banks in non-Central European countries, then, you know, even during the sort of last 2 years, it was maybe paying 2.5-3%. So that's one that, you know, we want to be able to you know, offer term deposits to the customer base we've grown over the last 16 years. And then the second aspect is that it allows us to operate across Europe in a more streamlined manner. And what that allows us to do is to have, you know, more countries, you know, where we lend. And as a result, the risk diversification of the portfolio becomes bigger, right? So that there's more and more granularity, not in terms of any more of, okay, the individual borrowers, but, you know, kind of the geographic and specific macroeconomic risk related to one or another region kind of get balanced out as well. So, like, ideally, you know, in the end, there's, you know, you could kind of take this as this, you know, go and grow of Europe, where, you know, you can get like super diversified, you know, portfolio of loan fractions issued across Central Europe, not Central Europe, but all across European Union. And if you look at, you know, look at all the products available in the world, there's nothing really that gives investors that kind of access, right? So there's maybe a couple of asset-backed securities and securitization products, but these are typically accessible only to institutional investors. And even there, you know, the risk diversification, the geographic diversification is maybe 3-4 different countries. So ideally, in the end, you know, we want to provide a kind of like for investors, you know, one click investment opportunity, be that for term deposits or go and grow, to have a, you know, effectively a, you know, investment that's backed by loans all across European Union.
I remember like conversations in the past, or I think also back then 6 years ago when I came here the first time, or it's a different office, but where you were,
like, across the street.
Yeah, across the street, where Ergo took over now. That back then, I think it wasn't a discussion to become a bank or apply for a banking license, as far as I remember. Do you remember, like, when this shift came from going that direction?
I think we've known that this is inevitable from quite early on. but inevitably in the sort of like time scales that we're kind of looking at planning at the business, so you know, rather in decades than a few years, you know, because the key people around the business really have a very long-term view about, you know, growing the business, you know, over the next 50 to 100 years, right? So it's a long-term plan, and we've known this needs to happen at one stage, because regulation is quite uneven still between banks and other institutions. There's a lot of access to information and markets that banks relish that we see that if you don't go down that path, you know, we saw that we don't go down the path, we will not be competitive. So we knew that part already, you know, a long time ago, that there's some, let's say, not macroeconomic, but regulatory sort of trends that push it. But I think the first time we thought about this was 2016, 17, 18. 2019, we're kind of like, you know, had it already somewhere in, let's say, a long-term roadmap as just an item. Mm. And, you know, it kind of like started to grow, you know, from just an item until now, end of 2022, early 2022, we finally took a decision, okay, you know, we start working on this path, right? But initially it was just a kind of like one of the projects that our legal team was looking into, what does it need, etc. You know, we hired you know, MD or the CEO for the bank to be, you know, now close to 2 years ago, who took over, started to put together the team, to put together the, you know, business plans around this. So, and you know, we've started to very actively change the way the company structured, you know, the people. It will be announced pretty soon where we're standing. We're having a, you know, we've just had a new supervisory board put in place by the shareholders. You know, where there's three people who managed, you know, big banks in the past, who bring in a lot of like finance and risk management experience from banks. You know, we brought in. In terms of overall risk management, we're following the sort of you know, three lines of defense, let's say, approach that's a standard for financial institutions, how we structure the teams. There's like a separation between the people who take decisions, then the separation between the people who kind of like, you know, provide oversight on those decisions, monitoring and risk governance, and then there's separately internal audit. On top of that, there's like, you know, very professional supervisory board who, you know, looks after it. So there's a lot of governance and risk management work that goes into this. So when you kind of like asked, you know, why are we confident that we're able to deliver what we set out to deliver to Gomercro investors over the next 10 years, is that we're doing a lot of work to ensure that this will happen, right? And there's a lot of investments in terms of people, talent, and infrastructure that is going into that. Hmm. But it's quite long, right? Why we were also saying 5 years, it takes a lot of time, right? So it's first you need to kind of like build out the organization, and all the documentations, all the processes, you know, also IT systems more or less, you need to have in place before you actually kind of like, you know, go into the application fully.
Hmm. And once that point in time will come and you obtain that license, what is the likelihood with all the compliance that you will have to fulfill then? You will also disclose, let's say, what we discussed in the beginning, manage portfolio, performance of your assets. What are the chances, you know, there will be this added layer of transparency that I would say is currently lacking?
So if you think about, you know, as a bank, you would publish anyway every 3 months audited accounts, right? You know, which cover a lot of your activities. So the entire banking group basically needs to publish a lot of information, but then it comes into a very specific standard form, right? That is defined, you know, to all of the banks and how it's there. How Go and Grow will sit inside of the bank and with the bank is still something we need to figure out. Like, how do they work together, you know? Because you know the product like Go and Grow is not a typical thing that you would have inside of a bank or inside of a banking group. So we need to still, you know, this is one of the big topics we haven't decided upon, how those two will interact. You know, can they remain in the same group, or we need to kind of split them up, or you know what to do? It's still quite open. We've seen different things happen in different parts of the world where this has happened. You know, so I think there's the Radius Bank or Lending Club example, and then the SOPA, and then there's Fellow Finance. So you know, these are all sort of different experiences on the market that we're looking at to find the, you know, the best way actually how to combine, you know, the business we built over the past 16 years, and then the business, you know, that needs to be a foundation also for the next 50 to 100 years.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, lastly, a private question, if you allow. I know back in the day you said like you're all in Bondora with your personal investments. Is that still the case, or have you added any other assets to your investment portfolio recently?
No, other than the house I live in, you know, then everything I have in terms of my personal wealth is either in shares of Bondora or in Go and Grow.
Okay, so that remained the same. All right, then I think we come to an end. Yeah, thank you very much for your time. I mean, you know, just a little last note from my end. You know, in the past years, you know, I've been always like pointing out certain things with Bondora, which, you know, have always had the interest of improving the platform, or, you know, pointing out certain elements for investors to be more aware of. And I really appreciate that, because we couldn't manage to meet last time, short term, unfortunately, but greatly appreciate that you allowed me to be here today. So we have this conversation and, you know, allow me some more critical questions on the business development and of Bondora, of the company. So much appreciate. Thanks for the invite once again. And yeah, all the best of success for your future endeavors and projects.
Thank you. It's great to have you here, and it's, I know, I feel, you know, it's good for me to answer those what you call critical questions. I think we, you know, we have quite strong logic and arguments for that guide us in our decision making, and we're not really afraid to discuss them, you know, just in a normal, let's say, blog post, you know, website format. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't sort of like, you know, work out in a way to put that on a banner, but we're always happy to comment and you know, discuss these topics.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Peter.